告诉我。
For our time purposes, Ms. Lovell and I are splitting the time. I will be arguing for about 15 minutes, and we've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, that said, thank you. There are, the appellant, Mr. Kaho'o Halahala, has brought two issues before this court. The first issue has to do with the jurisdiction of the Board of Registration. The other issue is the board's decision in light of the evidence that was adduced at the hearing and the evidence that was presented during the letters, or the, lack of a better term, the pleading stage. I would like to begin with the jurisdictional argument, the jurisdictional issue. The Maui County Clerk receives two types of grievances. And these two grievances, while they begin with the clerk, objections to nomination papers and challenges to voter registration, once the clerk has made a decision on either of those, they go in different routes. Once the clerk has made a ruling on an objection to nomination papers, that is under Chapter 12, that goes toward the circuit court for review, if any. If it's a challenge to voter registration, it goes a different route, and it goes to the Board of Registration. The Board of Registration's jurisdiction is limited severely to hear only challenges to voter registration. Mr. Dupree brought this appeal from the clerk's ruling. However, Mr. Dupree's initial letter to the clerk in no way asserts a challenge to voter registration. The letter itself takes issue with Mr. Kaho'o Halahala's residence because he was running for office. It constitutes clearly and unequivocally as an objection to nomination papers. And from
Mr.
that,
Lowenthal, doesn't the letter make factual assertions, though, that challenge the residency of Mr. Kaho'o Halahala on the island? He says he has family here, but he doesn't live here. That factual allegation, if true, would indicate that Mr. Kaho'o Halahala should not be registered to vote in Lanai'i, correct?
That factual allegation alone can serve as the basis for both a challenge and an objection. But the letter itself expresses a type of relief. I believe the last paragraph of the letter says, Saul is a fine candidate, but why doesn't he run in the district that he currently resides in and give a current Lanai'i resident the opportunity to represent their home island? So while it is true that that factual assertion could be ample grounds for a challenge, this factual assertion could also be grounds for an objection, and that is what his letter is doing.
But doesn't the statute, HRS 1125, impose an independent duty on the clerk to investigate when allegations are brought to his or her attention about improper voter registration by way of a signed written complaint by a voter? It actually says the clerk shall, as soon as possible, investigate and rule on the challenge. So in light of that duty of the clerk, would not this factual allegation have been sufficient to trigger the jurisdictional power of the clerk and actually obligation of the clerk, one might argue, to move forward?
Well, Your Honor, because there are two separate statutory schemes, in Chapter 11 having entirely to do with voter registration and challenges to voter registration, the statutory duty imposed by the clerk does not come into play or is not invoked unless there's a challenge to begin with. So we submit that while this factual assertion is in the letter, unless it is properly constitutes a challenge, that duty is not invoked.
Are you suggesting the clerk should have ignored this allegation that Mr. Kaho'o Halahala was not a resident of Lanai'i and simply allowed him then, without investigating, to vote on the island?
No. What we are submitting is that this letter constitutes an objection to nomination papers, and the clerk has a duty in that under Chapter 12 to do certain things. Now, the clerk did do that here, but the clerk also made an analysis under chapter 11. The remedy we seek is to vacate the board's decision, and this is a difference between our position and the clerk's position, and that part of the clerk's letter that does the chapter 11 analysis, because the chapter 12 analysis is clear that it's an untimely objection. And while this is a factual assertion, the remedy was also clearly stated, and we believe that the clerk's duties were met by simply ruling that it was untimely after the investigation.
HRS 1125A, the first sentence in that paragraph says, challenging prior to election day, any registered voter may challenge the right of a person to be or to remain registered as a voter. So would that first sentence indicate that the last sentence, that the clerk shall investigate a challenge, indicate that that challenge is not a challenge in any general sense, but a challenge related to registration?
Yes, we believe that is correct. As a matter of fact, under Chapter 12, they don't call it a challenge at all. They refer to it as an objection. And so the legislature, in passing these two separate schemes, was very clear. They said this is what a challenge is, and it's a challenge.
Dupre argues that, at least in the appeal from the Board of Registration, from the clerk to the Board of Registration, there is a reference to challenging petitioner, well, Mr. Kahlo, as not being registered in the precinct. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. The appeal from the clerk by Mr. Dupre essentially goes into the Chapter 11 analysis and characterizes it as a challenge.
So if there's any problem, does that language in the appeal from the clerk to the Board of Registration cure the issue?
We don't believe so, because jurisdiction by this board being so limited can only review a challenge from the beginning, can only review what the clerk has done. And as a matter of fact, the record also shows that Mr. Kaho'ohalahala brought a motion to dismiss, raised these grounds, and they concluded that the clerk had it right, and that the clerk properly construed Mr. Dupree's letter as a challenge, which we're taking direct issue with. And so, while Mr. Dupre did appeal from the clerk's ruling on these Chapter 11 grounds to the board, I guess as a preliminary thing, I should mention that the clerk's ruling ruled on all 12 letters. There were 11 other letters, and it is unclear, based on the language, whether Mr. Dupree's appeal can go forth if his initial objection was something entirely different. We believe that it is essentially bootstrapping in order to...
What is the burden of proof here?
The burden... I would ask...
What is the burden of proof before the board?
Before the board in finding... That is a... uncharted territory as far as measuring the pleadings and scrutinizing the pleadings. There was a hearing on the matter.
The board's order cites to HRS 91. Does the Administrative Procedures Act apply?
That would be getting into the issue of whether this is a contested case and whether someone's rights were at issue.
Well, the order cites 91. Is that correct or incorrect?
Don't believe it would be correct for this analysis.
It also cites to an administrative rule, I can't recall, as authority for establishing preponderance of the evidence as a burden of proof. So is that accurate or inaccurate?
I think the burden of proof for, and I just want to be clear on this, you're asking Justice Acoba, the, burden of proof for the board in examining whether the initial letter to the clerk constituted a challenge. Is that correct?
Well, the issue first is who has the burden of proof and on what? And what is that burden of proof? I ask you the second question first.
Okay. I believe the burden was on Mr. Kaho'ohalahala to bring the motion to dismiss and to assert that this was an improper, that there was no jurisdiction to hear Mr. Dupree's appeal. As far as the burden of proof goes, I believe the standard burden is something like preponderance of the evidence, although it is unclear here because we have specially delineated procedures and statutes for this board. So whether it's the Administrative Procedure Act under Chapter 91 or not hasn't been fully outlined or fully demarcated. As far as the other, because there was no jurisdiction from the beginning for the board to hear Mr. Dupree's challenge, simply because he did not assert it in his initial letter to the clerk, the entire proceeding should be vacated. Vacated, and along with the clerk's analysis under Chapter 11, although it is along with the that analysis. The other issue in this case, we'll move on to the other issue unless there are questions here. The other issue is the board's decision in light of the evidence. Chapter 11.13 is clear. And it says the rules for determining residency. And what the board had to determine was whether Mr. Kaho'ohalahala resided on Lana'i, in the Lana'i precinct. And I think there was a lot of confusion on the part of the board in the evidence that they were supposed to look at and the evidence that was essential in resolving this question. The evidence, the law is clear, and it asks for physical habitation in the precinct and an intent to return to that habitation when that person is absent. The evidence that was presented by Mr. Dupree was anecdotal evidence that Mr. Kaho'ohalahala was not seen at a gas station, he's not seen on the island of Lana'i enough, and therefore he's not a resident in sort of a common understanding. But that's not what the standard is. Mr. Kaho'ohalahala presented evidence that he was returning home to 444 Fraser Avenue in Lana'i City, that his family accepted that and welcomed him. And Mr. Dupree's own witness, Mr. McComber, testified that he had seen Mr. Kaho'ohalahala at the harbor and being picked up by his brother at the harbor and seen him on the island. The law of domicile, which is analogous to this, shows that you don't need a time requirement. I believe there is the case, I believe it is Powell, that says that, you know, there's no time requirement. A person could be there for a day, even an hour, and that would suffice.
Mr. Lowenthal, wasn't the critical fact in the board's analysis the fact that Mr. Kaho'ohalahala had registered to vote in Lahaina in 2006? So the board, in fact, found that he had been a Lana'i resident up until 2006, but that by registering to vote in Lahaina, he'd given up his Lana'i resident, had become a Maui resident. So when it's analyzing, when it was analyzing his registration on Lana'i in 2008, it wasn't considering him as someone who was coming there to vote after a long, unbroken period of residence on the island, albeit having left the island at various points to do other things, but as someone who was seeking to change their residence from somewhere else to the island of Lana'i. Would you agree? The board thought that was a very significant distinction. Would you agree that it's a significant distinction? And if so, how would you analyze it?
I do agree it's a distinction, and it cannot be ignored. However, given the record and given this evidence, if the burden is on Mr. Kaho'ohalahala, essentially it's a shift in the burden, and if the burden is on him to show that he indeed returned to his home island after registering in Lahaina in 2006, there's still ample evidence that shows that. The And so we, because in addition to registering in 2008, it's much of the same evidence. And so, and it is much of the same standard as if he were to prove that he had returned home. Again, you have the affidavits, which are after 2006. You have testimony of Ellen Pelissaro, who said that he was residing with this, he was residing, or had a house in Lahaina. I don't want to confuse the terms. He had a house in Lahaina, and she had testified that they often wanted to go back to Lanai. That, on top of his affidavit, his brother's affidavit, and Mr. McComber's testimony.
Where's the evidence of physical presence? In other words, if you look at the statute, it recognizes the two situations are different, and HRS 1113.4 talks about, the test you talked about before was the general test for domicile, but that talks very specifically about changes in residency and requires both an intent to acquire the new residence, physical presence in that place, and it would seem implicit, the abandonment of the old residence, both in some physical sense and through some act of, or through the intent of the person. Where is the evidence that Mr. Koho'o Halahala had taken some additional steps to establish a physical presence in Lanai'i sufficient to become a resident there when he is now coming from off-island as a resident of Maui?
Well, we submit that the threshold or the type of evidence or the amount of evidence, the quantum, is not a high threshold to meet because this statute and these rules apply not only to Mr. Koho'o Halahala, but people who have to live elsewhere and when they intend to come home. And so we submit that the physical presence or the physical habitation requirement doesn't require a lot of evidence. It is similar to college students who return home or to people who have second homes. I believe there was a case from the territory of the Knutson case that discusses this matter. So
if evidence was received at the hearing, is some deference accorded to the board in terms of the weight of the evidence and the credibility of the witnesses?
I don't believe that this is a credibility issue. And as far as
a credibility in the sense of who you believe and how much you believe of what you hear, isn't that involved in the hearing?
To an extent.
And then the weighing of the testimony, isn't that also involved?
It is involved in the abstract, but at this hearing, it was clear that even Mr. Dupree's own witnesses had testified. Again, I turned to Mr. McComber, testified that Mr. Koho'o Hala was, in fact, on the island. And because there's no time requirement, and because the law...
How many times did he see him on the island?
I believe the evidence showed that there were two instances. One when he was picked up by his brother around long after 2006, and another time he was seen at a rally. And he wasn't participating in the rally, but he was there in the crowd.
Would that be sufficient to establish any substantial or significant presence on the island or to indicate that he regularly stayed on the island of Lanai?
With the word substantial or significant...
Okay, let me put it another way.
Okay.
So could the board take those two instances and weigh it against the testimony of... who was it? The other testimony of Mr. McComber and Mr. Dupree, and look at the fact that Mr. Koho'o Halahala, had registered previously in Lahaina and worked in Wailuku. His house and his, I guess, was in Lahaina. And could they take all that evidence and weigh it and decide that therefore Mr. Koho'o Halahala did not live on Lanai?
There are a couple of cautionary things as far as the statute goes with those rules about those factors. For example, working in Wailuku, there was evidence that also he was working there as employed of the state, so that cannot be considered. Another thing that cannot be considered is the residence of his spouse, which was in Lahaina. So taking those into account and weighing these...
The fact that he was working on in Lahaina, but also registered as a voter in Lahaina, would that offset the fact that normally, well, the rule says you don't need to count service with the state? Would that offset that?
I don't believe it would offset it, because I think...
But would it be another thing to weigh when you decide whether or not the fact that he worked for the state should have, decisive weight?
Yes, working for the state should not be a factor in determining whether he is a resident where he says he's not. For example, in this case would be Lahaina. The fact that he registered in Lahaina in 2006 and now he is registered in 2008 in a different precinct on Lana'i, that does come into play. But again, I think that is more of a question of burden shifting and not evidence in itself. I think there's an administrative rule that talks about that, saying it is rebuttable. And we submit that it has been rebutted given the evidence that was here. The focus of the board was on evidence that was not dispositive of the question of residency.
Counselor, let me ask you this. Ellen Pelissaro testified that Mr. Kaho Ohalahala had held various positions representing Lanai, right? What years did that entail? For example, he was on the he held the Lanai seat on the Maui Colony Council, was on the Citizens Advisory Committee, state representative from Lanai, represented Lanai on the Hawaii Sovereignty Commission. Any of these years include the period of time 2006 to 2008?
I believe from 2006 to 2008, and this is without, but I believe during that period, Mr. Kaho Ohalahala was working with Maui Community College in the state of Hawaii. I also believe he was working with KIRC, the Kaho'olawe Island Reserve Committee, which is also with the state.
I'm referring to now Ms. Pelissaro's testimony concerning his elective sitting on Lanai seats, representing Maui Council, the Advisory Committee, the Sovereignty Commission. This was representing Lanai.
Yes.
And this wasn't during the period 2006-2008. Is that right?
I don't believe so.
Let me ask you this. Was there a computation of how many days he was in Lanai between 2006, July, 2008, July?
I don't believe there was an exact number or calculation made.
Okay, your understanding is that the evidence showed that he was on the island only twice, once for the rally and once when he was picked up by his brother at the dock?
I believe the evidence, those were two clear instances of when he was seen on Lanai, yes.
How many days was he there?
I don't believe the record establishes that.
When there was a motion, when there was a request to clarify testimony from Mr. Kaho'olawa, you objected?
I was not the counsel below.
Who's counsel?
He's not here today.
Okay, but there was an objection and there was a refusal to allow Mr. Kaho'olawa to explain certain parts of his testimony.
Yes, there was an objection.
You know why that was?
I don't know. I see that I don't have my time is up, and I believe his level has our case to argue to.
All right. So. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. If I could return to one of the questions that was asked previously about who had the burden of proof. the findings of fact and conclusions of law conclude that the person bringing the proceeding, namely Mr. Dupre, had the burden of proof. And the citation was to Chapter 9110, and there was also a citation to Hawaii Administrative Rule 2-51-43H. And this is very important, the burden of proof, because it's our position that Mr. Dupre, as the challenger, did not meet the burden of proof with the evidence that he submitted. Now,
Does 91 apply?
Yes, I believe it does, Mr. Justice Okoba. Administrative Rule 2-5143A says that the appeal shall be exempted from the provisions of HRS Chapter 91 regarding contested case hearings. But if you go over to 25143H, it says rules of evidence as specified in 9110 shall be applicable. So I believe that the Board of Registration got it right in terms of who had the burden of proof. That was Mr. Dupre. I believe they got it wrong in who had met that burden of proof. Dupre submitted only two witnesses, himself and Mr. McComber. Mr. Dupre talked about not having seen Mr. Kahoʻohalahala. He talked about utility bills and that sort of thing. But then the Board of Registration made a very incorrect finding of fact. They said that Mr. McComber, the other witness who was presented by Mr. Dupre, had not seen Mr. Kahoʻohalahala on the island. And I believe it was the two instances that Mr. Lowenthal was referring to are actual instances where Dupre's witness, McComber, admits that he had seen Mr. Kahoʻohalahala on the island. Now, these are not important so much to show that those were the only two times that Mr. Kahoʻohalahala was on the island, but rather that Dupre's own witness had, in fact, seen him there.
But, counsel, didn't Mr. Dupre himself acknowledge that those two instances had taken place? So although the board entered this erroneous finding about Mr. McComber's testimony, in fact, the evidence in the record from Mr. Dupre himself was that these other instances had taken place.
Yes, I believe his testimony was somewhat rambling, but I believe that would be a fair reading. Now, Ms. Pelissero testified on behalf of Mr. Kahoʻohalahala, and despite the fact that there was no actual counting of days or hours, she did testify that Mr. Kahoʻohalahala had returned to the island to care for family members who then died. She also indicated that Mr. Kahoʻohalahala had and his wife had very frequently expressed to her the view that Lanai was their home, the place of their ancestors, where their children and grandchildren lived, the place they always intended to return to. Now, under Hawaii law, and particularly under Powell versus Powell and Anderson versus Anderson and the Knutson case, all of which were cited in our papers, there is no particular period of time in which to reestablish Lanai residency. Anderson versus Anderson says 1 hour is sufficient. Powell versus Powell says 1 day is sufficient. The Knutson case, very similar to this case on its facts, says that the very act of registering to vote, exercising the vote, and standing for election from a particular precinct are strong evidence of the intent to return, which is paramount in determining legal domicile as opposed to the physical place where you may be temporarily residing.
Also, don't you have to look at the actual context in each particular case? In this case, again, the context, as the board found, was that you have a Maui resident or someone who become a Maui resident now seeking to establish residency on Lanai. And while There may be no particular time that they have in which to establish residency or no minimum requirement. Nevertheless, there has to be some, under the statute, physical manifestation of residency and implicitly an abandonment of the residency in the other place. But as I understood it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Pelissaro testified that at this time of these events, Mr. Kohoʻohalahala was still working on Maui and still residing in the house on Maui.
I think the important thing to look at is, did he reestablish his residency on Lanai? It's our position that he did, that by returning to care for family members, by his affidavit, which says, I returned home, by his brother's affidavit, which says, we welcomed Saul home. Those are all evidence that he has returned. Now, he, of course, still has his temporary residence in Lahaina. That is not disputed. But just as the council member whose factual situation was looked at in Attorney General Opinion 86-10, the person who ran from a particular district, actually he may have been a legislator, but he ran from a particular district on Oahu, moved out of his house into a rented house in a different district while his home was under construction or remodeling with the intent to move back in. The Attorney General's opinion, which was relied on heavily by my client, Mr. Haraga, who is, by the way, here today with us, establishes that when you've got a temporary residence somewhere else, what you look at is the intent. Where is the intent for your permanent residence to be? And in an island...
The statement in that opinion, that intent determines residence, is not entirely correct, is it?
Well, you do have to have intent plus...
Is it entirely correct? Is that entirely...
It's correct as far as it goes, but...
So we really have passed that. We know that you need at least some kind of physical presence.
Yes, and I would agree, but...
So that if you, as apparently the board read the clerk's opinion, focus only on that, because I think that's what the clerk's decision said, then that would not be a correct statement of the law, would it?
Well, I believe that the clerk was very careful in the way he looked at the evidence.
Well, it's almost word for word from the Attorney General's opinion.
He did cite to the Attorney General, and I think he cannot be faulted for following an opinion of the Attorney General. But he had other evidence as well. He had an additional affidavit of Mr. Kohoʻohalahala. He had Mr. Kohoʻohalahala's link.
There's a presumption that flows from the fact that Mr. Kohoʻohalahala changed his precinct to Lahaina, meaning that it would be presumed that that is his new residence. And that, so when you came before the clerk or before the board, that presumption under this rule 25125 would apply, and therefore it would be Mr. Kaʻohalahala's burden to overcome the presumption that the Lahaina residence was his true residence.
Well, actually, if he had not changed his registration back to Lanai, I would agree, but in fact he does take affirmative steps. He changes his registration back to Lanai initially by filling out an affidavit. Then he follows it up with a second affidavit at the request of the clerk. He produces the affidavit of his brother, all to the same.
He makes the argument that he never says he lived on Lanai. Is that accurate?
I think that is accurate, but I think the problem is that it's difficult for all of us to separate legal domicile from the house in which you may sleep at night for convenience. And certainly in an island county like Maui, made up of four islands, three of which are inhabited, in an island state such as ours, it is not always possible to find work where your your legal residence is, and therefore you must maintain temporary housing elsewhere while you work on another island.
That you argue that the decision of the board exceeded its jurisdiction because it made reference to candidacy and the right of Mr. Kahualahala to serve on the council.
Yes.
What's the relevance of that? I feel like we're on the tail on this dog, and we're not sure what the dog is, because this election wasn't decided by one vote. So what's all this, you know, controversy over the board saying more than that Mr. Kahualahala was not registered to vote in Lanai?
Well, I think the clear intent that shines through initially the complaint letters and Mr. Dupre's appeal letter, his testimony, and Mr. McComber's testimony, it's all focused on the election and on Mr. Kahualahala's candidacy and ability to run as the Lanai candidate. And what I found very interesting in going back through the transcripts were that Mr. McComber and Mr. Dupre both told the Board of Registration that this is not about Mr. Kahualahala's right to vote. And I'm referring to page 30 of the transcript of October 31st, 2008, which is page 271 of the Record on Appeal. The then attorney for Mr. Kahualahala, Lance Collins, says, "So if stripping Saul of his right to vote on Lanai, would you disqualify him from being a candidate? You're okay with that, right?" And Mr. McComber, Dupre's witness, says, "I don't think his right to vote." And then Michael Dupre says, "That has nothing to do with this case." And McComber says, "Giving his right to vote is not really in question."
Well, Colin? Counsel, just to be clear, you represent the clerk. The clerk,
yes,
took the position here that he had jurisdiction to decide this matter as a challenge to the right to vote. So the argument you're making now is somewhat in tension with the position your client took previously.
Well, actually, no. I don't believe, Your Honor, that that it is. And that is because the clerk looked at the 12 letters that he had before him, and he looked at them in two ways at that time. However, by the time it gets, and I believe his decision was careful and based on law and correct, but after it gets to the Board of Appeal, now we have only one appellant, that is Mr. Dupre. You don't have these other people who filed these letters. And Mr. Dupre, unlike some of the other people who had written letters that the clerk addressed, had never really focused at all on the right to vote. He had focused all along on the candidacy for office. You see that in the relief that he's asking. He's asking that Mr. Kahualahala be stripped of the opportunity to run for office.
So Ms. Lovell, is your position then that although the clerk addressed it and rendered a decision that was appealed to the board, Mr. Dupre is not allowed to appeal certain parts of the decision?
Well, I think he could have appealed certain parts of the decision or all of it, but he did not. He focused on the election part of it. And if there's any doubt, and it's true that his letter is written in terms it's not entirely clear what he was asking in his appeal, but if there's any doubt, that is why I cite the court to Record on Appeal 271, because I think at that point he has waived the point. If he is telling the Board of Registration this is not about the right to vote, then what jurisdiction does the board have at that point? The board,
Ms. Lovell, aren't there, to be fair in this proceeding, Mr. Dupre was sort of all over the map in terms
of
what he wanted. And there were other portions of the proceeding where I think on page 244, in fact, he suggested there was a challenge to voter registration. And clearly his letter to the board did talk about voter registration, albeit, again, in the context of nomination papers. So there is clearly at least both issues once we get to the board. Would it be fair to say were at various points put in play by Mr. Dupree?
I agree that the record is not as clear on that point as we would wish. He was representing himself, and he was not as clear as he could have been. However, he did have the burden of proof. His evidence did not meet that burden, and it was an error for the Board of Registration to rule that he did meet his burden of proof.
If I might ask you something, Slovel, maybe a question to frame a general context, but what is your understanding of why the Maui County Charter requires that a candidate be a resident in the area from which he or she seeks to be elected?
Well, there are... I'm trying to think of how to respond without going outside of the record. The charter is a legal document, so if I can stay with just what it says, rather than going into its legislative history, which is not before the court on this record. The charter provides for different residency districts, and our county council has to have a resident of the island of Lanai, a resident of the island of Molokai, and a resident of the Hana area, as well as the larger island and larger communities on the island of Maui. But in order to satisfy the one man, one vote concern, our council members are elected by the electorate at large.
Wouldn't it be fair and common sense to say that in this situation, the charter would contemplate somebody who actually lives on Lanai, who's familiar with the concerns about water supplies and other things of that that only a resident on the island would be aware of?
I think the charter contemplates that one will be a resident of the residency district. But again, we are not looking at Mr. Kahoʻohalahala's election or whether his election was correct. We are looking at the only thing that the Board of Registration had the jurisdiction to resolve, and that was his right to vote. Secondly, again, one's legal residence isn't always where one temporarily resides. In the Knudsen case, for example, Mr. Knudsen had a home in Honolulu that he occupied with his wife and two children while his children went to Punahou. He owned a home elsewhere on Kauai, which is where his business was located, but he cited as his legal residence for election purposes to be elected, I believe, to the Kauai County Council, our Board of Supervisors, his vacation home way up in the mountains, up in Waimea Canyon, that was many miles off of a government road. And he only occupied that home on vacations and weekends. The territorial Supreme Court found that by declaring that to be his residence, by registering to vote in that district, by standing for election from that district, that indeed his Waimea vacation home was his legal residence. And Mr. Knudsen, like Mr. Kahoʻohalahala, had from time to time, according to the opinion, been registered in other places. But the territorial court looked at this totality of circumstances very similar to the case at bar, and found that under those circumstances, where Mr. Knudsen declared his legal residence to be one of three places where he slept under a roof at night, that it was his intention to make that his home, plus all of these other factors that made it his legal residence.
Thank you. Your time is up. Mr. Papchak.
May the record reflect that Mr. Dupree has flown in from Lanai with me today, our appellee. By refusing the board's invitation to testify in response to its questions, Mr. Kahoʻohalahala passed up an opportunity to counter the board's conclusion that there was no evidence that he abandoned his Lanai, his Lahaina residency. They, without authority, are attempting at this level to shift the burden to the appellee. And we know that the decision of the board is deemed to be valid, presumed valid, and its conclusion should be upheld unless unjust or there are unreasonable consequences. I note in the reply brief, which we didn't have an opportunity to respond to, Mr. Kahoʻohalahala actually mentioned several cases dealing with domicile. The most recent one of these is the In Re Estate of Marcos case that Justice Nakayama wrote the opinion on, and it cites three other cases which were cited by Mr. Kahoʻohalahala, Arakaki, Yamani, and Blackburn. These cases establish the criteria for abandonment of a domicile. There are four of them. First one is that once you've established one, it continues. The second one is that the person alleging a change in domicile has the burden of establishing that change. And to do that, they have to do two more things. One is they have to have an act and an intent concur to show the move to the new domicile. And four, they have to show an intention to abandon the old domicile. Now, these cases then go in and analyze the facts necessary to establish whether or not there's been an abandonment. And they find that Ferdinand Marcos, the Shah of Iran, Mr. Arakaki, and Mr. Blackburn didn't satisfy his burden, their burdens to show that they had abandoned their old domicile. Mr. Arakaki had established originally a Hawaii domicile because he had a job, a home, a family, and financial obligations in Hawaii. Then he moves to Japan and takes a job there. But this court found that that was insufficient for him to have abandoned his Hawaii domicile. Mr. Blackburn, in what I think is the foundational case in this area for Hawaii, was the only trial witness in his behalf. Yet this court concluded that his actions spoke louder than his words, and it was his conduct that established the most important evidence of his intention to abandon the domicile. When contradicted by decisive acts of habitancy, this court said, a declaration's probative force is very light. Mr. Blackburn was found to not have abandoned his California domicile despite a record that shows that he came to Hawaii with his wife with intention to establish a new home. He brought their furniture. Mr. Blackburn brought his daughter from a prior marriage. He also owned a business in Hawaii. Contrast this to Mr. Piper in the Yamani case. There, Hawaii was chasing Mr. Piper for taxes. He'd been a Hawaii resident, and he went off to Wake Island to work for the FAA. And 4 years later, he comes back to Hawaii. So they're trying to get the tax for those 4 years. This court found that Mr. Piper had abandoned his Hawaii residence. Why did they find that? It's because he moved with his wife and all his family. He had no real property or personal property and no bank account in Hawaii. He sold his automobile, sold his TV, sold his personal furnishings. He didn't have any club memberships in Hawaii. He did not vote in Hawaii. Court said his pulling up stakes was complete. We're going to return to that language. Contrast all of these to Mr. Kahoʻohalahala. Mr. Kahoʻohalahala pulled up no stakes. None. He's been living in Lahaina with his wife, where they own a home, for a decade. He voted in Lahaina precinct after swearing that it was his one residence and he had no intention to go anywhere else. He works on Maui. His wife works on Maui. There's no evidence of any physical move to Lanai. He didn't do anything to establish abandonment of Lahaina or to show that he had created a new fixed habitation on Lanai. Lanai is a small community. The testimony is that anyone living on Lanai knows everyone else that's living on Lanai. There's a single community square, shops around it, cafe, one of them is run by Mr. Dupree. They know who's on island and what they're doing on island.
Mr. Kupchak?
Yes, ma'am.
Is the Knudsen case cited by counsel still relevant?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, actually, I don't think there's any problem with that case. Mr. Knudsen re-registered back in his Waimea district for three elections prior to the one where the election prior in this case, we have Mr. Kahoʻolahala voting in Lahaina, and it's now his burden to show it out. We've had three other elections, I believe, in Knudsen. Now, I think everybody knows the Knudsen family. Kanuka of Kauai may have listened to this Eric on the radio when you were growing up. When he talks about the stories, it's a Waimea family. They come from Mana, and you go on and on in that context.
Does Chapter 91 apply in this case?
I think the Corp Counsel indicated that it does not apply. The rules of evidence were incorporated back in to it. So it's its own thing, and it allows you to do your pro se things and the like.
Who had the burden of proof in this case?
Well, as mentioned by Mr. Lowenthal, there's several different questions on burden of proof. But on the issue of residency in this one, initially it was Mr. Dupree's. The clerk concluded that he had the jurisdiction. Now, we can argue whether or not he had it or not and go into the facts behind it. Our brief covers that pretty well. But the point there is that once the clerk determined that, and I'm surprised, as indicated, that the clerk is here arguing against that conclusion at this level, because they didn't appeal that point. Then the question is, deference is given to the clerk's decision. Now, the board then picks it up, and the board likewise concludes that there was jurisdiction. We've quoted in our brief why he says he resides and things of this nature, and there are at least two places in the pre-hearing minutes where Mr. Dupree indicates that he's challenging the residency for voter on it. But then the board decides it's there. And we come back here under Kele'i Pulo'oli, where the board decision is now what's on appeal. It's presumed valid, and that burden is on the other side. So they've got to go several steps back in this case, and two levels of deference at least on that issue.
Well, Mr. Kupchak, don't we have cases that have subsequently cast doubt on the suggestion that it's presumed, the administrative agency's action is presumed valid, and rather we look at it in terms of a factual finding, the more traditional standards of factual finding, which is subject to clearly erroneous review, and a legal finding subject to de novo review, or a mixed question of law and fact, which our cases indicate would be subject to a clearly erroneous review as well.
I missed the question.
The question is, you suggested there's a presumption that we need to defer to
right.
The administrative agency's ruling, and my question to you is, isn't that presumption now, at a minimum, been further modified by our cases, if not cast on, or there's been doubt cast on it?
No, I don't believe that the deference provided to an agency has been eroded as a proper standard on the appeal and who has the burden on this regard. And that...
No, there's really no need for deference in this case, is there? I mean, we're not talking about some engineering or scientific issue that the court couldn't understand. We're talking about the election law and how it applies. Aren't we as competent at looking at the law as, say, the board and the clerk?
Far be it for me to suggest that you're not competent, Your Honor. But the point here is that if you're going to get in to deal with the facts and the application of the facts in every case, you're going to retry every case.
No, that's not, I don't think, what this is reckon law indicated. But we, with respect to findings of fact, then we would apply a clearly erroneous standard. And with respect to conclusions of law, we would apply a right-wrong standard. Right?
That would be generally the case. But there's only one issue of law here, and that is whether or not there's a presence required or it's just the intent, and I think Your Honor covered that one earlier. The rest of them are fact decisions, weighing the facts back and forth and then applying them. And this particular agency has been established for the expertise in this area to deal with this. And it's the perfect case for deference in this case, unless there's something that's just really off the wall. In this case, we are suggesting it's not off the wall, and if it, to the extent it is, the burden was on Mr. Kahoʻohalahala to move that, to show he abandoned the old residence, and not to, and done something affirmative to establish a new habitat on Lanai. In fact, Mr. Kahoʻohalahala cites the Arakaki case. Well, actually, one more thing I want to talk about. Someone mentioned about the election and what the role of the election is. Down below, the appellants objected to any reference to election coming in, but this court in West versus West has said that stuff's perhaps relevant. You say that the motive with which a person acquires a new dwelling place, even an unworthy one, may be important evidence tending to show whether or not the new dwelling place was acquired as it, with an intention to make a home of it. Okay, what was he doing in this case? There's a concurrence between the filing of the nomination paper and the filing of the registration change. Mr. Kahoʻohalahala refused to testify, so he didn't clarify any of that. So we can draw the inferences against him in this case. One inference might be that he was so hot to get back into the political fray that he wanted to get there, and he filed his registration change, not because he ever intended to abandon his residence in Lahaina or start anything on Lanai. That could be one reason why that was relevant, and you put that on the scale with all the other facts, it gives you a motivation on his part to show whether or not he really intended to move back. They're relying on a 1910 case from Massachusetts, which was cited in 1954 by this court in the Powell case. This is the Winans case. Mr. Winans and his wife moved to Massachusetts for the purpose of acquiring a fixed habitation there. They moved, they went there and stayed 2 weeks. Then they left to go see his mom. He's 40 years old, see his mom at a health spa because she's sick. In the interim, an apartment is acquired for him in Massachusetts and his belongings are shipped there. Then they have a dispute whether or not they should live in the city or in the suburbs. Mr. Wyman never returns. Unlike Mr. Kahoʻohalahala, Mr. Wyans had actually acquired an apartment. He had moved his wife, he had moved there with his wife and his physical effects on it. And further, and more important for this case, he had no fixed habitation to return to. It was found that if he had any beforehand, he was only in hotels on it. So like Mr. Piper, Mr. Winans had pulled up stakes beforehand. The day-to-day dicta, to the extent that it's still alive after Winans and Powell in 1954, I suggest is limited to their facts when you did Blackburn in 1960. As we noticed, Mr. Blackburn and his wife moved here. They brought their personal belongings here. And he brought his daughter from a previous marriage, which, like the suburbs issue in Winans, caused the relationship to fall apart. But Mr. Blackburn never pulled up stakes, according to this court in California. The presumption was that Mr. Blackburn had not abandoned his California residence on it. Mr. Kahoʻohalahala has only offered declarations, and they're not entitled to prima facie evidence once attacked by a registered voter. The devil's in the details, as we have seen, on 2 points. One is on his intent and his act about forming a new one, and on whether or not he abandoned his old domicile or residence. Mr. Kahoʻohalahala satisfied neither of these. He didn't pull up the stakes. The Arakaki
question of jurisdiction,
yes,
that's been raised by Mr. Kahoʻohalahala. Was there jurisdiction in the first place for the clerk?
Yes. His letter, and we've quoted, says he
died. The indication is none of the letters raise registration as an issue, but rather nomination and candidacy as issues.
And I suggest that he raised the issue that he didn't reside there, which was discussed earlier. And for a non-attorney portion under a liberal proceeding, that should be sufficient, particularly where there is some duty on the clerk to make sure that his roles are correct.
Mr. Kupchak, doesn't the statute by its terms seem to suggest that the challenge must raise the issue of registration as a voter? As Justice Acoba said before, any registered voter may challenge the right of a person to be or remain registered as a voter. Does that imply that the challenge or the written challenge must in some way, perhaps indirectly at least, but in some way specifically indicate that it is a challenge to voting registration as opposed to some other issue?
Well, I will say that under the common law forms of pleading, we had these pigeonholes that you had to hit. But once we shifted to notice pleading, you had to know what it was that was being chased. In this case, the clerk understood what was being chased. He so stated, gave appropriate notice to Mr. Kaho'o Halahala, and the investigation started. Nobody was prejudiced by this. Everybody really knew that there were two things going on, and the clerk so stated there were two things going on. And that was, then we get back to our deference issue again on this. There's the agencies that are charged with determining whether or not they have any jurisdiction. Your court sent it back saying, don't come here, it's a jurisdiction matter in the prior case. Clerk determines he's got it. You got to be given some deference. The board also concludes that it's there. And again, we're saying that if someone's trying to appeal that, they've got the burden to come up on that issue. And I think the record, there's no question what was going on here. He didn't reside on Lana'i.
I didn't think the commission's decision seemed fair. And I'll tell you why. It doesn't even mention Palisaro. I mean, I don't think, it doesn't mention Palisaro. It doesn't mention what she testified to. And she was apparently one of the few witnesses for Kahala. Now, nobody challenged that. But, I mean, there's a lot of evidence there. It's never mentioned in the commission's report. The clerk also testified, apparently. And he's not even mentioned in the report. So how fair can we believe this hearing was? They leave out references to the two witnesses that testified in behalf of Mr. Kalohalohalo. Is that a fair proceeding?
Let's take a look at what they said. Mrs. Palisaro indicates that he'd gone back to his family, help him when they're sick.
Whatever they said. I mean, they testified on behalf of Mr. Kalohalohalo. They're not even mentioned in the proceeding. It's as if they never appeared in the proceeding. Why? Why is the commission's decision written that way?
Because they didn't, among other things, identify those efforts to the time period in question. Each of you have asked the question about when these things occurred. The record doesn't reflect that. This was Saul's burden, Mr. Kaho'o Halahala.
And the clerk's testimony is relevant.
The clerk's testimony is actually in the decision in that the clerk's the one that brought in the prior registration.
Not even mentioned as a witness.
They say that the prior registration showed he was in Lahaina. That came in through the clerk. They didn't technically go back and say, we have this in the record.
That's
because...
That's what I meant to ask you. Was there any evidence of his registration in Lahaina? Was there some record?
Yes.
Okay.
It's one of the exhibits.
It doesn't say how that was entered into evidence or who brought it in.
It's Exhibit 1, I believe. And it's in the record on appeal, and it was the clerk that introduced it. So I'm saying that the facts are in the record on it. And the question of who said what, I don't know if that's always a requirement in a decision that comes down, particularly when it's not a contested case required aspect under the law. This is designed for a quick resolution by some people or theoretically have some expertise in the area on it. And the record is what it is. We all have the record, and it was available to the public. Anybody wants to go look at it.
One side's represented, and one side's not in the record, in the decision.
That's happened to me, too, even at this level.
Mr. Kupchak, let me refer back to the testimony or the evidence concerning Mr. Kalohalohala going back to Lanai to take care of a relative that was sick?
There's some indication that there's someone in the family was sick and he went and visited sometime. They don't say how long, they don't say when it was.
Okay, was there testimony given just generally that he was there for several days?
There's no testimony at all that he ever stayed overnight that I could find. He came over for a rally. Someone picked him up at the dock during the window.
That was his rally?
There's nothing in the record. I don't know what it is. But, I mean, we're trying to establish a fixed habitation on Lanai, not come over for a political rally. Now, when my folks got sick and I went and visited them, I didn't lose my residency or abandon my residency here. It's something we all do.
Let me ask you this. Assuming there was no jurisdiction of the clerk or the board to deal with the nomination or candidacy issue, do you agree?
They didn't.
Because
do
it was
anything.
Just too late. The challenge was too late.
There are three suits on this, Your Honor. Okay. You've already dealt with one of them. There's one pending. The judgment came in down below. It's on its way here. And you'll get another chance to look at that issue. This one, the board, well, first the clerk said he's got two things. One of them had to do with this. Then the board looks at it and said, we're only going to take this one. And that's all they did. They stayed within their jurisdiction. Said, for the purpose of that election, he's registered in Lahaina.
Assuming that the court, affirms the board's decision, mm-hmm. What does it do to the issue regarding the candidacy?
Well,
is there an automatic result?
That remains to be seen in the case that's coming up. But let me go back and try to deal with that a little bit more specifically. The Keli'ipuli'oli case says that to turn it over, it must be unjust or result in unreasonable consequences. The first consequence of an affirmation is that Mr. Kaho'o Halahala will have been deemed to reside where he's always resided with his wife on Lahaina. Whether or not it has any play in the case below remains to be seen. And I'm glad to argue that case with you now, or do you want to wait for the to come up? It's on its way. The record on appeal is being gathered, and it'll be here. But if I like to say that the appellants bear a heavy burden to overcome what I consider to be the presumed validity of the board's decision, and the findings were neither unjust nor unreasonable in their consequences. It didn't say that they were unreasonable per se. They say unreasonable in their consequences. But this is so because of at least this following. One, his previous registration under oath, Lahaina, was his one residence, and he harbored no desire to leave. Two, that for a decade he's had a fixed habitation in Lahaina with his wife. Three, he refused to testify. The board had the right and the power to ask questions under HRS 1143. With counsel, nonetheless, he refused. So these inferences, I suggest, can be easily drawn against him, and he can't be heard to complain about that. Four, Mr. Kaho'o Halahala's failure to offer any evidence that he had abandoned his Lahaina residency. And we suggest that there's really no evidence that he established a new fixed habitation on Lanai. Then there's a testimony of Lanai residences that they haven't seen him living there. And I think most of us know if you live on Lanai, you really know who's living there. And finally, you can draw what inferences you want from the fact that he filed his nomination papers about the same time as he filed his registration to change. They haven't met their burden on it. We respectfully request that this court affirm the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order of the board. Thank you.
Yeah. How much time left? Okay. I'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you. I just wanted to address some points that were raised. The appellees rely heavily on Blackburn, Powell, I believe Yamani. These cases articulate the standard for domicile, which is something that we said is analogous to the situation. I think the question comes down to not so much the standard or what needs to be proved, but the quantum of proof. And the reason why we submit that the quantum of proof is significantly lower in cases like Blackburn, over divorce cases, cases over finances, because this is about a person's right to vote. And then you can strip someone and disenfranchise not only a person who's challenged, who they challenge, but a whole group of people. I mentioned the Dunn v. Blumstein case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case, kind of to get an idea as to why these challenges are here. There's no citation to it for Hawaii, but they kind of hint at it, that the purpose of a lot of these procedures of registration, challenging, is to avoid things like massive voter fraud. I think the U.S. Supreme Court, and we mentioned it in our opening brief, talks about situations where a whole group of people go from precinct A to precinct B, claim to be residents there, and vote for one particular candidate. That is a classic case of a voter registration challenge. And so when we talk about the right to vote, we submit that that is connected to a quantum of proof, same standard, but similar to divorce cases and domicile, but a quantum of proof that is considerably lower, which is why we've been saying this, that the evidence that they looked upon, or that the quantum that they put on Mr. Kaho'ohalahala, or whoever the burden may be, is much too high. And to let it stand imposes a very high burden for every voter.
Mr. Lowenthal, do you think that Mr. Kupchak is wrong and that there doesn't need to be evidence of abandonment?
I believe that given the statute, that there doesn't need to be an affirmative proof of abandonment. Yes, I believe that. I believe that once you've established the new residence, or the claim based on your voter registration, that you don't need to automatically prove that you've abandoned the old one, given the statute. I mean, it's analogous to domicile, but it's different from it in that sense. I understand, Chief Justice Moon, you've been asking about periods of time. I just want to point out, on page 45 of the October 31st transcript, when Mrs. Pelissaro testified, one of the members of the board asked for how long a period of time was, question, do you ever know him being Mr. Kaho'ohalahala, moving back to Lana'i or going between those two jobs being the state jobs at Maui Community College and Kirk Kaho'olawe Island Reserve? And Mrs. Pelissaro testified, I know he was there on Lanai during that time because I was also on Lanai during that time when he lost some of his family members. So I know he was there for some time caring for them and caring for his mother. And again, this goes to, as you mentioned, Justice Sokoba, the decision, that's the findings and conclusions don't reflect that, don't reflect her testimony accurately. Thank you.
Take this matter under advisement.